So I don't understand why you're all here tonight. I mean, had a difficult day, the weather's been difficult, difficult things going on in your life, and in the evening you want to come and hear about more difficulties? I mean, why focus on the most difficult things? I think if those of you have seen the title of tonight's talk, The Four Most Difficult Things, not just difficult, but the most difficult. I mean, practice is hard enough without focusing on the difficulties. But difficult here really means precious. The things that are most difficult to attain, we tend to value the most. So it's important to understand what this teaching actually refers to. Actually, I wanted to mention something I forgot. In the course of two things, really. One, I'm going to have to use some notes tonight. I hope there won't be a distraction to you. But for those of you who know, chemo fog kind of rolls in and rolls out, and it makes it really difficult to think and see things clearly, so, but we can't stop living, can't stop doing the things that we need to do, so we deal with the fog. So I bring a certain amount of fog tonight with me. We'll see how much. And secondly, I'm going to be referring from time to time to teachings from Nisargadatta Maharaj. Some of you know, maybe most of you know. If you don't, I want to sort of bring him in tonight. He's not a Buddhist, thank God. He's an Advaita Vedanta teacher who lived and taught in Bombay. And he's probably the clearest teacher that I know of in terms of describing state of freedom, state of awakening, state of enlightenment. He's also quite a character. So I want to bring him in tonight and introduce him. So I started to say it's important to understand what this teaching of the four most difficult things actually refers to. It's really a teaching about awakening. Now, we can have all sorts of other motivations for practice. And techniques, practices like mindfulness have been incorporated into the mainstream of medicine and psychology. Sometimes, or increasingly actually, they get uncoupled from their original goal, and they're kind of offered as a standalone treatment for everything from stress reduction to neuroimmunology. And they work. They do what they're advertised to do. But at the same time, we tend to stop asking the deeper spiritual questions about our very existence. I think when the first generation of Westerners came back from Asia, we came back all pumped up, right? We were bringing something home that wasn't here. And that had mostly to do with this freedom from suffering and enlightenment. But over the years, I've watched it get a little bit less and less and less. So it's not always the thing that we're pursuing. It's not always the thing that teachers teach. That's a whole issue in itself, why that's so. But it's important because how we frame our final destination and purpose and the direction we set and the means we use to get there, that will fundamentally guide our practice from beginning to end. So this teaching about the four most difficult things frames practice in terms of awakening. It's very uncompromising. It says, yes, the path is difficult, but awakening is not only possible, it's our nature to awaken. If you take one thing home with you tonight, take that. It's our nature to awaken. It's my nature to awaken. If you just took that as a kind of mantra, almost, because it's really true. It's our nature to awaken. But the teaching also says it won't be easy. It doesn't sugarcoat the path. It alerts us to what lies in store. It confronts our tendency to avoid, to deny, to procrastinate, to minimize. It doesn't say difficult, it says most difficult. In other words, if you're really, really serious about the depth of the practice, it will probably take everything that you have. When I first got to Bodh Gaya, I went there with the cover story of going to India was that I was doing research for my PhD. That was the cover story. That got me the money to go. But the real reason for going, of course, was to learn the practice and learn Buddhist psychology. And in the beginning, I was asking my teacher these, put together this kind of semi-structured interview like you're supposed to do for field research. I dropped that pretty quickly. But one day, I was out walking with him, and I asked him, what is the role of the teacher in the Dharma? And he said right away, there are no gurus in the Dharma. And that would be news to some traditions who are very big on gurus. No gurus in the Dharma. So I said, well, if the teacher's not a guru, what's the teacher's role? He said, the teacher has nothing to teach. He's just walked down the path a few feet or a few yards ahead of you. And so he knows where the potholes are. In other words, the difficulties. And his only function is to point out where you're headed and what lies ahead. Can't prevent you from falling into the potholes from time to time, but he does his best. And in Munindraji's spirit, that's what I'd like to try and do this evening. So the four most difficult things, anyone know what they are? They have this incredible sweep. The first most difficult thing is said to be taking human birth. Probably you would not have started there. The second most difficult thing is hearing the Dharma. The third is finding a teacher of the Dharma. And the fourth is waking up, awakening. So we'll take them each in turn. The first, taking human birth. What is a human birth after all? It's an odd way of putting it. We're born, we're here, we don't say I took a human birth. Well, in traditional Buddhist cosmology, you know, there are these six realms of existence. The heaven realms, the hell realms, the animal realm, the hungry ghost realm, and the human realm. And human birth is said to be the only realm from which you can attain enlightenment, become free. We had when the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw was still alive, back I think in 1980 or so, and he and his entourage came to a retreat at Yucca Valley in California. And Jack Kornfield, in his own inimitable way, always rushes in where angels fear to tread. Jack said to him, well, you talk a lot about enlightenment. Why is that so important? Now, what Jack expected him to say was, because it extinguishes certain factors that cause suffering. And not what he said at all. He said, because after first enlightenment, you will never take birth in less than a human realm. Within seven more births, you will awaken. I mean, what is he talking about? But that is very, very traditional Asian Theravada teaching. Human birth is said to be the most favorable for practice. Why? Because it has this balance of pleasure and pain. If you look at the other realms, they're either overwhelmed with pleasure, in which there's no motivation to work, or you're overwhelmed with pain, in which you can't work. But we have this peculiar balance where we experience not too much pleasure and not too much pain. So there's motivation, but we're not overwhelmed. Now, in this schema, human birth is said to be very rare, right? Do you know how rare it is, the metaphor, the traditional metaphor that's given for it? No? Has to do with a turtle, right? So there's this ring, this wooden ring that's floating on the surface of the oceans, and the winds and the currents push it this way and that. And in the ocean is a turtle, big turtle. That's swimming the oceans of the earth. And periodically, of course, has to come up for air. And that one time where the ring is floating right above the turtle, and the turtle happens to come up right through its opening, that's how rare human birth is. I mean, the point is not to do some kind of calculation. It's to impress upon us how fortunate we are and that there is no time to waste. That human birth is not an accident, not a random event, but a precious opportunity. A year or two ago, as I was walking through the square, I went by that little Tibetan shop, and they had a scroll. Not very large, about like that. It had a saying of the Dalai Lama's on it. And the first four verses are something like, I am fortunate to have woken up today. I am alive. I have a human birth. I'm not going to waste it. I put that up next to my cushion. Start every day with that statement of intention. I have a precious human birth. I'm not going to waste it. Well, it's not so easy for us today, being good modern secular Westerners, to subscribe to this whole cosmology. Manindra used to love to talk about all these realms, and you know, he taught people to visit certain realms, and he would always end his talking about them by saying, it's all true, but it's irrelevant. Just do your practice. And then he'd talk about another realm. It's all true, but it's irrelevant. Just do your practice. But we can reframe this teaching about cosmology as a teaching about our present situation, right? In which we take birth every moment in one of the six realms. There's a line from one of Bob Dylan's songs. I can't remember the song, but the line goes, he was not busy being born as busy dying. Do you remember that? Which song? It's All Right, Mom. Yeah. He was not busy being born as busy dying. Those are the choices. And actually, if you total up all of the mind moments in which we are distracted, preoccupied, daydreaming, inattentive, in comparison to the moments that we're mindful and awake, the ratio is probably not too different from the turtle and the life ring. So to take a human birth also means to embrace our humanness. That does not get talked about so much, to embrace our humanness, all of it. Instead of trying to spiritually bypass it bypass what we don't like or can't face through practice. And practice, of course, you all know, can be used that way. It can be used to bypass the things we don't like in our experience, or the things we don't like about ourselves. Now, that has one very practical application. Since it's the nature of our entire being to awake, right, all of us is going to wake up. The good, the bad, and the ugly. It's all going to come to the surface. Everything that needs to come to the surface will rise to the surface, including a lot that we've repressed. It doesn't always happen in day-to-day practice and retreat practice. It happens quite frequently. The mind gets still enough, quiet enough. This material surfaces. And a lot of the time we use meditation to try to keep it down, keep it repressed. But when we really start to let go and let happen, what needs to rise to the surface rises. And there's another way of thinking about this that I found helpful. There's a newer approach to therapy these days called internal family systems therapy. Any of you know that or done some? I really recommend it to you. It fits beautifully with Dharma, with meditation practice. These parts of ourselves it calls exiles, the parts of ourselves we've exiled, pushed out somewhere, sent away. And when you send someone into exile, you don't want to hear from them again. That's why you send them away. But when we begin to allow everything to awaken in us, these exiles come back. They come back because it's the nature of every exile to want to return home, right? And tell their story. But who wants to hear their story? Usually when they return home and they start telling their story, it precipitates a crisis because everybody that's still back home has got some kind of way of living worked out for themselves. They don't want these people to come back and disturb that. And yet, what these parts of ourselves want more than anything is just to be experienced fully. So the way to work with them when they arise in practice is to just let them have a voice and let them be heard. It's mostly what they want. They just want a voice and they want to be heard. You don't have to interpret them. You don't have to reconstruct them. If you really want to do that, come and see me in my office. But there is a way to work with them in practice, as I just said. Let them have a voice and let them be heard. And then our humanness, even our dark side, becomes a vehicle rather than an obstacle, becomes an ally rather than an adversary. A wrathful deity becomes a benevolent deity. Right? That's tantric practice. Some of you know Rodney Smith, who comes to the East Coast occasionally and gives retreats here. In Rodney's new book, he says, a lay Buddhist, he's taking issue with the Buddhist traditions that are heavily monastic in orientation. And a lay Buddhist is one who fully embodies his or her entire life of work, family, and relationships without spiritually prioritizing any activity. It's very powerful. Without spiritually prioritizing any activity, from this perspective, all moments are equally precious. The unequivocal resolve not to move away from where we are is essential. And once we abandon the belief that there is a more spiritually useful moment than the one we are in, we have embraced our life and infused it with the energy for awakening. That makes sense? It's beautiful. So being willing to not just be mindful of these mind moments, these things that arise and pass away in consciousness, and observe, just observe it like we're mostly taught to in Vipassana. But to actually work with them, make a place for them. Ultimately, even accept all these parts of ourselves. Without that kind of wholehearted, total acceptance, there's no awakening. So we can't leave any part of ourselves behind on this path of awakening. I was thinking about that the other day when my wife and I went to see The Life of Pi. Because I often think of our situation as sort of being in a lifeboat. The ship is sunk. Our ship is sunk. And somehow we managed to get in a lifeboat. But the trouble is the lifeboat's springing leaks. And we keep having to bail it and bail it and bail it to try and keep it afloat. Well, here's Pi. It's very interesting. He did not leave anything behind. He took everything that he could with him, especially the tiger, the least likely thing to take. And he would not kill the tiger. He would not push the tiger overboard. And ultimately, he learned to work with the tiger, right? That's tantric practice. That's the wrathful deity, the tiger. But Pi found a way of working with him. So our humanness is not just the difficult parts, although we tend to focus on these. But it's the good parts also. When I first got to Bodh Gaya, there was an Australian woman who would come to practice with Menindraji. She'd been there about maybe 6 weeks. And she had come straight from having made her third suicide attempt. Very serious. She planned it very carefully. It was an absolute fluke that someone discovered her in time. And she said, "This is crazy. I can't live like this." So she went to Bodh Gaya to see if she could find some way of living her life. She was a rough, tough woman. She'd been in the Dutch underground during World War II, and her exploits were legendary. She was one of the people that fed back information to the Allies that led them to choose the two beaches in Normandy where they landed, where the Allies landed. That was largely Carol's doing. They finally rolled up her network, 20 of the 21 people in it just months before the end of the war. And they tortured Carol for several days, and she said, "I knew the next day I wouldn't survive." But that night, a team of Dutch commandos broke into the prison and rescued her. But she was a very broken woman after the war. Two unhappy marriages, alienated from two kids. A geologist by training, but so difficult to deal with that the Australian oil industry blackballed her. And then she made these three attempts on her life and ended up in Bodh Gaya. And the first winter she was there was the first winter I got there. She experienced first path, that's first awakening. Adyashanti calls that a non-abiding awakening, but it's still an awakening. It's very important. And she came back the next winter with only enough money for about 6 weeks. And almost to the day, she experienced second path, second awakening. And then she said a really, really interesting thing that I've never forgotten. She said, according to Buddhist teaching, after second path, you only return to the human realm one more time. She said, and this may just be more Buddhist mumbo-jumbo bullshit. But, it was a Woody Allen moment, just in case, I'd like to come back one more time and experience the good things that I know this life has to offer. Because if she practiced and attained third path, she wouldn't come back. So she said, I'm not going to practice the third path. Extraordinary. And she and I would exchange letters every Christmas. About 10 years went by, and I got a letter in the mail one day, opened it up, and she said, whoops. I slipped up. I'm not coming back. And so far as I know, she hasn't. So another way of putting this, I found in Teilhard de Chardin, the French Jesuit, he's an ecologist, an archaeologist, a mystic. He said, we're not human beings on a spiritual journey, which is the way we normally think of ourselves. We're not human beings on a spiritual journey, but spiritual beings on a human journey. I'd really encourage you to think about that. Take that to heart. All right, the second most difficult thing is hearing the Dharma. And that doesn't seem so difficult at first. It certainly isn't hard to hear the Dharma with our ears or our eyes. It's everywhere. We're bombarded with teachings, right? Whether you turn on the radio, the television, CD. Unlike every other society in history, which had very limited choice of what path they might be able to practice, we've got them all. Have your pick. It's like walking through the supermarket aisle and having 65 brands of cereal. They're all there. We actually have the opposite problem. And this kind of supermarket shopping, spiritual shopping, actually makes it more difficult for us, I think. You know, there's an old Indian proverb that says, how do you find water? It's a very real question if you live in the Gangetic Plain. How do you find water? Do you dig 100 wells 1 foot deep, or do you dig one well and keep on going till you hit water? Well, put it that way, the answer's obvious. But the point is, we may not need to dig 100 wells, but we need to dig usually a bunch of wells until we find one. But when we found that one, it's important to really keep on going till you hit water and not get distracted. Otherwise, you can go on sampling. It's like a Whitman's chocolate sampler. You can go on sampling a different taste forever and get nowhere. Well, that raises the question, then, how do we know who to listen to? This was a problem in the Buddha's day, even with the Buddha present. In the sutra, the Kalama Sutra, he's in the land of the Kalamas, he's another itinerant preacher, and he gives a Dharma talk one day, and somebody raises his hand from the back of the audience and says, look, Monday it was Swami so-and-so, Tuesday it was Bhagavan so-and-so, Wednesday it was Sri so-and-so, and here it is Thursday, and now it's you, and how are you any different? Why should we listen to you? It's one of the great sutras in the canon. And the Buddha's answer is wonderful. He says, you're right to doubt in a matter which is worthy of doubt. You're right to doubt. Test it. Don't believe anything just because I say it and I'm the Buddha. Test it out in your own life. Nisargadatta talks about the readiness of the student to hear. If there's no readiness, there's no hearing. He says the teacher is always ready. You are not ready. I mean, he's very uncompromising. The teacher is always ready. This is in response to a question from a particular student. You are not ready. You have to be ready to learn, or you may meet your teacher and waste your chance by sheer inattentiveness and obstinacy. Take my example. This is one of the great saints and sages of 20th century India's talking. Take my example. There was nothing in me of much promise. But when I met my teacher, I listened, trusted, and obeyed. That's remarkable. There was nothing in me of much promise. He really meant that. But when I met my teacher, I listened, trusted, and obeyed. That's not a Western attitude. And consequently, you know, he had his great opening, great awakening, within about 3.5 years. Over and over again, he says, I trusted my teacher. He told me who I was, and I believed him. And then the student goes on, did you get your own realization through effort or through the grace of your teacher? Turns out to really be neither. Nisargadatta says, his was the teaching and mine was the trust. My confidence in him made me accept his words as true, go deep into them, live them, and that is how I came to realize what I am. His person and words made me trust him, and my trust made them fruitful. And the student goes on, whose is the effort? And the Sargadatta says, the effort is the disciples, of course. The teacher gives the instructions, but the inner teacher sends the strength. The alert application is the disciples. Without will, intelligence, and energy on the part of the disciple, the teacher is helpless. That's really interesting. The teacher is helpless. The inner teacher bids his chance. Obtuseness and wrong pursuits bring about a crisis, and the disciple wakes up to his own plight. Wise is he who does not wait for a shock, which can be quite rude. So what a teacher is addressing when he teaches is that in us which wants to wake up. He's not addressing the mind, not addressing thoughts. The words and the concepts aren't important. It's that in us which wants to wake up being touched. And we have to be willing to allow this again and again. It usually doesn't happen only once. Sometimes it's a still, small voice within. You know that voice, a still, small voice. Sometimes it's the roar of thunder. In either case, it's ours to respond to the call. He says, the inner teacher is always already awake and calling us. So why is this hearing difficult then? Well, because what we hear disturbs our inner peace, our routine, our living arrangements, our compromises, disturbs the deals we've made with ourselves. It can expose our lack of courage and conviction, our illusions and fantasies, our fear of exposure. So there's that in us which wants to wake up. But there's also that in us which wants to be left alone. That doesn't want to be pushed. That wants to reset the snooze alarm for later. We also aren't always listening when we think we are. I mean, think back to a recent conversation you had where someone was really trying to make a point or get you to understand something. And ask yourself, was I really, really listening? Usually when we listen, we're judging and analyzing and commenting while we're listening. And so it gets filtered through all of that stuff in our own mind. In other words, we listen to the Dharma with our mind, and mind can never comprehend what's beyond mind. No matter how many times we try and do it. It's kind of crazy when you think of it to try to use the mind to heal a mind. How's that going to work? So a student comes to Nisargadatta and he says, I'm tired of all these mental acrobatics. Is there a way to perceive reality directly and immediately? Like, that's a great question, a very deep question. Is there a way to perceive reality directly and immediately? Nisargadatta says, this is another takeaway tonight. Stop making use of your mind and see what happens. Do this one thing thoroughly, that is all. Try that. Stop making use of your mind. Do that one thing thoroughly, that is all. So the third most difficult thing is finding a teacher. This is really important to me. It wouldn't be maybe as important to everyone, but it's played a great role in my life. I was sitting in the Topeka airport one evening waiting to catch a two-seater to Kansas City to get home. And I had a long wait in this Quonset hut that passed for an airport. It's a little Quonset hut in Topeka. And I had been writing this dissertation. It was getting longer and longer and bigger. It was all about insight meditation. And I thought, now when I get this finished, who do I want to really remember? Who do I want to dedicate it to? And I remember taking the back of an envelope, and I started to write down all the people I felt had been benefactors of mine or teachers of mine. I got this big list. I had no idea I was indebted to so many people, and so many people had a hand in helping me on the way. And I, over the years, I've come to think of that as my greatest blessing, that there has always been someone there when I've needed them. Well, teachers come in many guises. That's another thing that makes it hard to recognize them. When I first met Manindraji, I'd taken an overnight train from Calcutta and a rickshaw to Bodh Gaya. It was cold and hungry and dirty and totally disoriented. And I got there, and Manindra finally came downstairs. He always would run late. He came downstairs, this little man with this white khadi cloth garment on. And, whoa, he doesn't look like a guru. But I said to him, all right, I'm here. I finally made it here. I'm ready. I'm ready to go. Tell me what to do. And he said, how are your bowel movements? Actually, they weren't very good. And he had his priorities straight, even if I didn't have mine. So without regular bowel movements, how am I going to sit for 18 hours and attain anything? So the first 2 weeks there, we spent correcting my bowel movements. His father had been an Ayurvedic physician, so he knew something about it. He'd give me all these herbs. But he sure didn't look like a teacher, or someone that I was going to learn a lot from on first meeting. You know, if we have a preconceived image or idea about who a teacher is, we'll only see what we're prepared to see, or what our biases allow us to see. It was interesting because the other main teacher of Vipassana teacher in India at the time was Goenkaji. Some of you may have studied with Goenkaji at Shelburne Falls. Anyway, he did look like a guru. He was heavy, Meninja was very light. He was this sort of very short Bengali who was very excitable and emotional and talked all the time. And Goenka students would just walk by him and without even paying him a moment's notice. Their take on him was that he was a lightweight. That's the word I heard. He was a lightweight. They only knew. Well, Carol, this Australian woman I was describing to you, her first impression of Menindra was that he was a zero. She'd come all this way to study with him, and day after day she'd go and meet with him in his room. He just opened his door in the morning. If you wanted to come, you went, and if you didn't, you didn't. And she would go and argue with him and fight with him and curse him, and she cursed like a sailor. And she called him every name in the book. And finally one day she said, furthermore, she said, this sucks, and you are a terrible teacher. And if you haven't got anything better than that, I'm going home. Furthermore, you haven't even taught me meditation, and that's what I came here to learn. So he looked at her and he said, oh, you want to learn meditation? Why didn't you say so? So then she started her practice over again within 6 weeks. As I told you, she had experienced first path. Or even the Sagadatta himself, he doesn't look much like a teacher. He looks like this old man with a permanent scowl on his face. He's gesticulating wildly all over the place. He inherited a bidi shop from his father. Bidis are these little Indian cigarettes. You roll some tobacco in a grape leaf, smoke it. That was his profession. And he had a room upstairs over the bidi shop. This is a little room that was beastly hot. And that's where people would gather and he'd give his teaching, just wildly, and sometimes he'd shout. For years he tried to get his wife and his daughter to practice. And they wouldn't have any of it. Sometimes he'd stop in the middle of his discourse upstairs in that room and he'd shout down the stairway to his wife and his daughter, presumably trying to get them to come up. I mean, there's a videotape of him that you would not believe. And yet, one of the two or three greatest teachers in India. The only one I know who's as clear about that state of awakening is Adyashanti, in a very Western idiom. Thanks. Well, another difficulty with finding someone to teach us, we tend to look outside ourselves for a teacher. We ignore the teacher that's in here. I guess there are a number of reasons we do this. We can't imagine how we would proceed. We don't see our own basic goodness. And Dalai Lama, when he first came to America, said he could not believe the amount of self-hatred that Western students had, completely foreign to him. We aren't used to living from our Buddha nature. We don't trust this inner teacher. We're like Nasruddin. You know Nasruddin, the Sufi trickster or teaching figure? Like him, we look for love in all the wrong places. There's a famous story of him rummaging around under a street light looking for the key to his house. He locked himself out. And he's looking along the curb under the street light, and a friend comes by and says the obvious question, did you lose your key here? He said, no, I lost it over there by the house. And his friend says, well, then why are you looking for it here? He says, because there's more light here. We do that all the time. So we look outside ourselves because we have made mistakes, we've experienced failures, and because the world is just so confusing and confounding, we want to be told what to do. We want to practice on someone else's authority because we don't entirely trust our own. And that may be a first step, practicing on someone else's authority, but ultimately it's got to come back here. I know that I don't know. Someone must know. I know it's not me, so I look for that someone. Which leads to a tendency to idealize teachers, right? Instead of trusting them, idealizing them, seeing them as something bigger and better than they are. We need them to look that way so that we can feel safe and confident. Adyashanti's talked a lot about the climate of projection that teachers tend to live in, all of stuff that gets projected onto them. Actually, there's an amusing little anecdote about that. He was being interviewed once about this climate of projection, and the interviewer said, well, how do you deal with it? He said, well, I try to be mindful and awake, not buy in. And the interviewer said, well, come on, that's almost never enough. What else do you do? He said, well, I tell my mother and my wife to keep an eye on me, and if they see me getting too big for my britches or trying to be some kind of a guru, they should tell me. The interview was great, didn't give up there. He said, oh, come on, you don't think your mother and your wife are going to say anything to you, do you? He said, yeah, I don't think they're so enamored of me that they won't call me out if they need to. Well, idealizing a teacher is probably inevitable. I think we've probably all done that at some point or another. And maybe we need to do it in the beginning. Maybe it's a first step toward getting engaged or toward discovering ourselves. But if it persists, it aborts our own learning. And it sets up a division in the Sangha between those who know and those who don't know. And we see ourselves and our teachers as fundamentally different when we're not different at all. It also activates our inner conflicts around authority, right? Provokes a lot of resentment and envy, shame, rebelliousness. So we end up on this seesaw of idealizing and devaluing, idealizing and devaluing. And the question remains, how do I find a teacher I can trust? Or as the student said, must I not examine the teacher before I put myself entirely in his hands? Great question. And the Sargadatta says, by all means examine him, but not by how he appears, not even by his character and temperament. That's hard for us, because we do judge temperament and character. This is a wonderful way of thinking about it. The only way you can judge is by the change in yourself when you were in his or her company. Isn't that right? The only way you can judge is by the change in yourself when you are in his or her company. If you feel more at peace and happy, if you understand yourself with more than usual clarity and depth, it means you have met the right person. Take your time, but once you have made up your mind to trust them absolutely, and follow every instruction fully and faithfully. Once you accept somebody as your teacher, listen, remember, and obey. Half-heartedness is a serious drawback and the cause of much self-created sorrow. I remember once in New York, I think after a conference maybe, listening to His Holiness the Dalai Lama talk to a very serious student. The student brought this question to him, how do I find a teacher? How do I know who I can trust? And His Holiness said, if it takes 5 years, if it takes 10 years, if it takes 15, he said, even if it takes 20 years, test the teacher until you are confident. Because once you make that commitment, it's karmically a very powerful commitment and has consequences. So test as much as you need to, examine as much as you need to before making any commitment. You know, the famous teaching story from the Hasidic tradition where the rabbi is asked, you know, why he went to see this particular teacher. And he said, I went to him not to hear his teaching, but to see how he put on his shoes. So I think a good teacher will give us back the self that we've projected onto them. They won't accept it and take it on as their due. They'll give it back to us, but they'll give it back in a way that won't make us feel embarrassed or ashamed for having projected it in the first place. And they won't encourage the projection. This is the behind the Theravada notion of a Kalyanamitta, right? Rather than the guru, the Kalyanamitta is the description of the teacher. The spiritual friend is what that means. Spiritual friend. That's the way I came to see Manindra, more like a brother and a friend. We also can overlook ways in which our life can be a teacher. Teacher's not only a person. Life can be a very powerful teacher. Adyashanti tells a story about himself in this regard. He said, when I came out of the womb, I was competitive from the first moment. And he became a cyclist. And he knew he wasn't the biggest or strongest cyclist, but he felt he could outcondition anyone. And he drove himself relentlessly. And he did become a nationally ranked cyclist when he was, I don't know, late teens, early 20s. But he pushed himself right over the edge and ended up in the hospital first and then in bed rest for 6 months. Then he had his first awakening. And he went back to doing exactly the same thing again, even after that first awakening, because that doesn't solve all problems. And he pushed himself again into the hospital, into another 6 month bed rest. And then he finally got it. He said, there were a whole series of identities that I gave up at that point that I just knew were illusory. And that was his practice at that point. I'm sure you've all had real life moments that have been teaching moments that demand everything. For me, recently, it was a year or two ago. It was being told after a surgical biopsy that I had cancer. Some of you probably know what that feels like. Your mind just stops. It either just goes crazy or it just stops and freezes. But I don't ever remember anything motivating me so much to practice. It just sent me back to practice like nothing I'd ever experienced. And it became in what Thich Nhat Hanh calls the bell of mindfulness. Not the bell I would have preferred, but a pretty loud and insistent one that I couldn't ignore. And life has been different ever since. All right, lastly, the fourth most difficult thing is awakening. Actually, I should stop and ask whether you really believe there is such a thing. I mean, really believe, not just lip service, or because someone else told you. But do you really believe it? Because if you don't really believe it, ain't going to happen. In fact, doubting that there is such a thing as awakening is one of the two biggest obstacles. I mean, it's hard after years of practice, and you know, we don't get there, and life goes on. And it's sort of easy to kind of slip into a state of mind, well, it's just not going to happen, but I get a lot out of practice anyway, so I'm going to continue. Then it's particularly helpful to have embodiments of people who are awake, and they can show that to us, because it is our nature to awaken. Never doubt it. Manindra just used to assume it would happen. He said, if you do practice, that's what's going to happen. You're going to wake up. Not a shadow of a doubt. And that confidence, that conviction was contagious for people that studied with him. So what's the problem then? Why is it difficult? Well, for some people it isn't difficult. They don't put up a lot of resistance. Though for most of us it seems to come out of a struggle with some difficulties and suffering. The second major obstacle is our very thought that awakening is difficult. That thought itself will stop us in our tracks. That it's only for the gifted or lucky few. Or it's only for those who can devote themselves to practice. Or only for those who can do long retreats. Or only for those who wear robes. All of those derail us. All of those thoughts will derail us. Well, we may believe there is such a thing as awakening, but we don't believe we are capable of it. You know, in Asian Buddhist countries, they had a way of handling this because most people do not practice for awakening, even in traditional Buddhist countries. When Milford Spiro did a study of Burma and Burmese Buddhism, he found only 5% of the monks themselves meditated who were practicing for awakening. It made me think back to the Christian monastery I belonged to right out of college. And I would say that 5% figure is accurate across the board. And what people would tell themselves is they'd say, oh, you know, it's just too hard right now. Conditions aren't favorable. So what I'll do is I'll work to attain merit in this life so I'll be born in a more favorable condition in next life, and then I'll practice. One day, Adyashanti was in a dining hall during a Zen retreat, and he heard these senior Zen students who've been practicing for 20 or 30 years talking among themselves about what they'd gotten out of it. And they were kind of laughing and joking and being very lighthearted. And one of them asked the other, well, why are you still practicing? He said, I don't know why I'm still practicing. I just do it because I do it. I've been doing it all these years and I get something out of it. Adyashanti was appalled. Just appalled. Whether he interpreted the situation correctly or not is another matter. Maybe not, but how easy it was to just sort of settle for something so much less and to lose that edge, to lose that deep desire. Another issue is that we're often afraid of our own aspirations. They get labeled as desire, and desire is a bad thing in Buddhism. But we can't attain what we don't aspire to or set an intention toward. Remember the Dalai Lama's scroll saying, Today I'm fortunate to have woken up. I have a human life. I'm not going to waste it. So the last two difficulties with awakening, each one of these could be a whole talk in itself. We misperceive what awakening is. We say, so-and-so woke up, or I will wake up, or I want to wake up. It's not the I that wakes up. It's not the me that wakes up. It's, if this makes sense to you, it awakening wakes up from the me. That makes sense? Awakening wakes up from the me. It isn't that I or me wake up, because there is no such. It gets turned around. The experience is, you call it spirit if you want, or Buddha nature if you want, wakes up from its imprisonment in the me, the want and the ego. That's how it happens. I don't become enlightened. And thinking of it that way and practicing for it that way is also, we're making it so much more difficult for ourselves. It may be gradual, it may be sudden, but usually it takes all we have, a kind of total surrender. Student again, how does one reach the supreme state, the fully awakened state? Nisargadatta says, by renouncing all lesser desires. As long as you are pleased with the lesser, you cannot have the highest. Whatever pleases you keeps you back. Until you realize the unsatisfactoriness of everything, you're sounding like a Buddhist, right? Its transiency and limitation, and collect your energies in one great longing. Even the first step is not made. Collect all your energies in one great longing, a cry from the heart. Well, Kapla Roshi, talking to a student, said, how will I know? And Kapla Roshi says, you won't know unless you cry out from your guts, I must know. Those I know who have gone the deepest in practice had reached a point in their lives where they weren't holding on to very much anymore. I mentioned Carol to you. She had let go of pretty much everything by the time she arrived in India. Deepama, whom most of you have heard of, right? Student of Manindraji's. She had lost, well, she was married at 12, sent to Rangoon to live with her husband at 14, was supposed to have a child right away, and 18 years went by and she had no children. She said her husband was wonderful. He never pressured her, never pushed her, never made her feel ashamed. But inside her, there was a shame. Finally, she conceived. When everyone had given up, she had first child, second child, third child, all pretty much in a row. And then one day her husband came home from work, said he didn't feel well, and by morning he was dead. And then she lost the first and third child, all within the space of 3 years. And she said, I was on fire with grief. I was on fire with grief. And she said that the doctors had given her 2 weeks to live. And she said, if that's all I have to live, how can I find something to take with me when I die? It's an odd question. She said, I looked at my dowry. I knew that was, couldn't take that. I even looked at my daughter, my surviving daughter. I knew I couldn't take her. What could I take? She said, let me go to the meditation center and see if I can find something there. So she went, she started practice in the evening. The next day she's walking across the campus and she can't move suddenly. She's frozen to the spot. And for a long minute she just stood there. Finally she looked down and this big bull mastiff had clamped his jaws around her leg. But she was already so concentrated that she never felt the pain. So they rushed her to a clinic. She got rabies shots, had to wait a while before she came back. When she came back, in 6 days, she'd done the whole course of practice. She'd let go of a lot already. So a misperception of what awakening is, and then lastly, a misperception of how awakening occurs. I wasn't sure I wanted to put this in because it raises so many questions. But the basic idea is it does not happen through doing anything. We think of practice as doing, that we're doing something. Awakening comes from someplace beyond doing. It's not us or anyone that's doing anything. If you take a really radical position on that, like Adyashanti does, he's against using any techniques, that to him they're all attempts to control the mind or manipulate the mind. Even noting, he would say, is. On the other hand, if you need to use it for a while, he'd say, fine, but do less and less and less and less and less and less until you're not doing anything. Now, that doesn't mean you turn into an insensate log. What it means is you're letting all of that activity go, and you're just resting in one of the Tibetan teachers calls it natural great peace, resting in natural great peace. And it's out of that resting, that non-effort, that awakening happens. So he started one talk by saying, meditation is the art of learning how to do absolutely nothing. But nothing in this very special sense. Because there's nothing we can do to make it happen. But we can sort of put ourselves in the way of it happening if we, in a certain sense. So, to conclude, it turns out there is a fifth difficulty. The Dharma is relentless. And that is, after awakening, we find out that awakening or enlightenment doesn't solve all of our problems. And in fact, in some ways, we've only just begun. Again, to go back to Kapla Roshi, a student came to him in a sesshin and said, I thought after Kensho is awakening in Zen tradition, I thought after Kensho all my problems would be solved. And Kapla jumps right in. He says, no. Kensho just reveals them. Now the real work of aligning your behavior and your thinking with what you've realized begins. In that sense, there's a lot more work to do to bring our life into alignment with our realization. And also to discover the infinite number of ways that Dharma can manifest through us. That's very important. It's not just about having an experience. It's the different ways we can manifest that. But that's a talk for another time. So I want to end with something that I took home from Menindraji, another one of his teachings, where he used to say, mindfulness, simplest thing in the world, most difficult thing in the world. Okay. So that we went over a little bit. I'm sorry for that. If some people have to leave, please feel free to leave, and I'll be happy to stay here and talk with anyone who wants to.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.